Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about giving you the full context and content. This is why this year we're starting off. We're gonna chronologically go through what we've been covering, so that we're gonna chronologically go through from the uprising, the revolution, the rebellion, all of that, so that you can kind of see what the framers, or I should say, what our founding fathers did. How did they respond? Why did they respond that way? So that we can start placing context to what do we do in a civil way in dealing with out-of-control government. Now, we have, I'll just say, there's all sorts of paths, and we talk about this, in ways to resist. But folks, because we've failed to actually hit the mark, we're nowhere closer today than we were in the 1800s post-Civil War in getting government to get back into its framework. And so this is why we give you this content. So we ask and continue to provide so that you can learn, pray, act. And again, it is all about demanding full compliance of the Constitution. That is the process. And there's actually a formal process of doing that, which we cover as the First Amendment petition. But all that being said, welcome back, Sean. How are we doing today? We don't have Tammy, by the way, folks.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
All right, great. So we were covering the Articles of Association. And then the next step, we're going to cover the First Amendment petition that they provided for the king, which we talked about yesterday, and how the king made probably the most monumental, or, you know, I'd just say, if there was an example through the annals of history of making a bad business decision, I think King George literally provided you never ever want to do that. I mean, it was just all encompassing because it had cost Great Britain legitimate, standing and so forth. Because had they actually kept America, this whole world would be a completely different place. As a matter of fact, the Second Coming would have already happened by now. Because the world would have actually gone, into the crapper a lot faster and so forth without us. But anywho, all that being said, we were going through the Articles of Confederation, and we just finished Article 5. Now, you didn't have time, Sean, to respond to what you'd kind of read, but is there anything that you have in your mind that you wanted to go back and cover or comment on, what have you?
No, sir. I think we're up to speed.
All right, great. So let's dive forward into Article 6. There's a total, of 14 articles. Some of them are kind of long, but most of them kind of short. Anyway, so let's dive into Article 6, which is very short.
That such as are owners of vessels will give positive orders to their captains or masters not to receive on board their vessels any goods prohibited by the said non-importation agreement on pain of immediate dismission from their service.
Okay, so again, economic measures, Article 7.
We will use our utmost endeavors to improve the breed of sheep and increase their number to the greatest extent. And to that end, we will kill them as seldom as may be, especially those of the most profitable kind, nor will we export any to the West Indies or elsewhere. And those of us who are or may become overstocked with or can conveniently spare any sheep, we'll dispose of them to our neighbors, especially to the poorest sort, on moderate terms.
And there you go. In other words, they're not only going to not provide, obviously sheep is one of those things that they were providing. And so they're not only going to provide, but they're going to create a better economic advantage by not killing them off, by not, you know, putting them into the market so that they can actually help, you know, share the wealth with the poorer segments of, you know, the community and the colonies. Okay, so the eighth article.
We will, in our several stations, encourage frugality, economy, and industry, and promote agriculture, arts, and the manufacture of this country, especially that of wool, and will discountenance and discourage every species of extravagance and dissipation, especially all horse racing and all kinds of games, cockfighting, exhibitions of shows, plays, and other expensive diversions and entertainments. And on the death of any relation or friend, none of us or any of our families will go into any further mourning dress than a black crepe or ribbon on the arm or hat for gentlemen and a black ribbon and necklace for ladies. And we would discontinue the giving of gloves and scarves at funerals.
So in other words, scarves and gloves probably meant that they would be consuming a product of England. And I mean, so now you're looking at just, you know, how they're going to function in their day-to-day lives of responding by not buying certain things or not doing things. And I would think that probably the proprietors of the gambling, horse tracks and so forth, are probably being operated by British citizens or companies for the crown, charters for the crown, what have you. Because why else would they boycott those? Does that make sense? Now, I know that...
Well, I would think that it's more austerity measures to conserve what they have.
Okay.
And not have to rely on other things or rely on selling things to make money to for the economy. So their disposable income, they're going to save it or use it in better ways than gambling and...
Right. That, now, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I do know this, that in some of the books that I had read, the framers talked about gambling and how it was becoming prominent in America. And everybody had dabbled in, you know, the track racings and so forth. And I don't know if they were doing horse racing or, you know, the extent of all of these things. But it was viewed upon as a novelty by the framers, not so much a problem or anything else. They knew that it was, you know, a waste of money. They knew those types of things, that, you know, you wanted to stay away from it. I don't think that they looked at it as, you know, as we look at it today. As a matter of fact, let me actually go back to our history. After, you know, the nation moved forward and some of these things kind of grew, some of the empirical data started coming out that gambling was a path to ruin for a lot of people. And the paradigm back in those days was to have blue state laws. You know what a blue state law is?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay.
You used to have those here.
Oh, okay.
You couldn't buy hardware on Sunday.
But you could buy alcohol 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. So to me, a blue state law is more of a law for sin, keeping people from being able to harm themselves. So many blue state laws would be you couldn't buy liquor on Sunday, you know, force people to, you know, sober up and go to church type of thing. That to me, hardware.
Well, it has to do with the Sabbath.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
The highly Catholic area, sure. So that was one of their things.
Yes.
You couldn't open your hardware store. You're not supposed to work.
Okay, so I remember, you know, when I was growing up, most all stores were closed on Sunday. Most all of them were. And it wasn't, you know, as a matter of fact, we were the generation the baby boomers were the generation of seeing the unleashing of the Sabbath in America, where it became more and more common that not just a few restaurants and hotels for travelers and those types of things, they started allowing wholesale, you know, anything and everything on Sunday, entertainment and so forth. This is where states stopped having these blue laws and started allowing, you know, people to do what they want to do. So let me ask you this. Is America better in creating laws and regulations to keep people from doing things? Or would America, in a Christian perspective, as, you know, Christian to Christian, you know, like, just let's look at the adulteress. In that point in time, there was a, you know, there was a punishment for sin. And that was to be stoned for the sin of adultery. So when when Mary was being accused, and the, you know, everybody had stones, and they basically, you know, asked, you know, what would you do? And Christ said, well, he among you would, without sin, go ahead and throw the first stone. And they all walked away. So the question is, did he, because at that point in time, that was a law in regulating behavior, right? So in other words, it wasn't like you go to jail. I mean, if you get caught, you know, doing something like that, that kind of sin or that type of action, you know, you're dead. It was a capital offense. Is society better off having capital offense type of laws, in other words, Old Testament, or is it better that we be free to choose for ourselves in all things?
Oh, we have to have some law.
We have to have some law. So how do we get to a place? Because I think, you know, I think all Christians would agree that we would want to get to a place where people don't choose to sin. Right?
That'd be kind of tough. It's on each individual, you know?
Right, no, but okay, so... the city of Enoch being, you know, so righteous that it was caught up. How did that city get to a point where people basically, you know, turn their back on sin and, you know, those types of things to, you know, live righteously? Well, how, you know, so how is it that we can do that in society? How can we create, you know, New Orleans as the next city of Enoch?
I don't think it's possible.
You don't think it's possible?
I don't. I think that the only time that we will have that is when Christ is king. And that's the purpose of his kingdom. Because there's always going to be free will outside of the choice of God's will.
Yeah, okay. So I think one of the things that we have to stop doing, not only creating laws for the punishment, I mean, it's one thing to do that, because we know that that's just a deterrent. But I believe that one of the things we have to stop doing is enabling the behavior. In other words, giving people welfare or giving people stimulus checks, giving, you know, having government give to people. That's got to end, because it's the same thing with the drunkard, the drug user, or what have you. Because we give, you know, because they get themselves into such a state, they get taken to the hospital. The hospital basically, you know, revitalizes them, gets them, you know, capable of walking and getting out. And, you know, who pays for this? The person that lives on the street does not pay for the medical care at all. Not at all. And they're put back out on the street and start consuming drugs again. And this is a very vicious cycle, and it's a very cruel cycle, because as long as there is that safety net, people can run around with reckless abandon. Well, you know, look, I've almost died four times, you know, and thanks to the good people of this city, you know, they've resuscitated me so I can get high again. If you understand the insanity, then we have to stop enabling this. We have to basically say, if you want health care, then, you know, I'm an advocate for, you know, making it so on car insurance or any type of insurance, if you're driving a motorcycle and you're not wearing a helmet and you get injured, you know, to where, you know, your face can, you know, needs all sorts of surgery, you know, you pay for that yourself because you neglected, you opted to wear that helmet, not wear that helmet. You opted not have a seatbelt. In other words, making people responsible for their own actions and their decisions. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely it does.
Because I think...
I'm just curious. I mean, since we're talking about these things in context of the way the framers envisioned it and in the world that they lived in, what was the instance of that degenerate person who just embellished their free will to the point where they were, you know, outside of society? What was the frequency of that at that time? Because what strikes me is all the machinations that have happened through what we talk about, government overreach and collusion between, you know, people who want money and power, and what they've done with the government to create these scenarios, like you were talking about the homeless people and maybe, or the drug addicts in the street. When Biden was in office, they were passing out crack pipes paid for by the federal government.
Right.
So,
and phones.
I mean, you can see that how one feeds into the other. The degeneracy and the immorality just escalates exponentially as the corruption continues. You know, and now we have to the point like what happened with COVID, where they just took over the government and twisted all our liberties into this ridiculous, you know, overbearing government that was arresting people for surfing.
Okay, so as I looked at the different periods of time where enlightenment in society grew, and enlightenment was growing in Europe. And enlightenment really, I mean, there was levels of art and literature, those types of things that, you know, were kind of accredited to enlightenment. And when we look at the enlightenment era of Europe, it's nothing like the enlightenment era of America. And I say that because enlightenment, as I've looked at the societies that really enlightened themselves, where they put aside the non-productive behaviors and so forth, and they really worked to become a great society. In other words, it wasn't just about avarice and selfish needs and wants. It was really trying to be a responsible member of the community and recognizing that your decisions have consequences well beyond just yourself, that your decisions can affect your family, the community, and in general, all. So the one thing that is necessary for enlightenment to really flourish in a society is discipline. In other words, people have to understand how to discipline themselves so that they don't succumb, so that they, you know, literally live a, you know, one of the reasons why I, on, you know, New Year's Eve, on that day of my show, I provide the, you know, the steps, or, you know, how to set effective goals. I mean, if you want to succeed, and the only way you can succeed in your goals is discipline. Right? I mean, you have to discipline yourself to not spend your money on these things so you can buy this to take care of that or what have you. You have to start applying discipline in your life. And a society that actually starts embracing and improving on self as well as communal discipline in helping each other and basically helping us to not make the wrong decisions. You know, you can have a den of iniquity in your town right now, but if everybody basically says, hey, you know, do you really want to destroy yourself by going in there, whether that be a bar or what have you? Now, right now, we just owe to each their own and so forth. But when we put the empirical data on the table, at what point in time is there really a need to destroy brain cells by going and drinking or taking drugs or whatever it is? We can find the arguments for health and all sorts of purposes why what that recreational task, you know, of gambling, pornography. So when we start looking at all of these different addictive things, I'm just talking about addictive behavior that kind of is a scourge of our society today. How do we do this? And we can shame people. We can put scarlet letters on them and so forth. And I believe that we need to find a better way of using a carrot instead of the stick. Maybe you need to have both. I'm a firm believer that you probably do need to have a stick carrot type of motivation factors. But I also believe that there's got to be a way to where people, you know, change their attitude to where they can embrace self-discipline, because you can't really start dealing with, you know, family and community discipline until the people themselves are willing to discipline themselves, right?
That's true. I feel Christ is the ultimate carrot and stick at the same time. It's very, very simple.
Sure.
And if people would, like you're talking about, people spending their time on recreation and entertainment and stuff, if they embrace Christ, like we always talk about, learn, pray, act, then they'll understand that there are rewards in life that are so much more than these shallow things that we embrace in society.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why those things are more prevalent in the power centers as we know them in this world. You know, entertainment and politics and sports and alcohol, gambling, all of those things are always promoted. Even now, it's just ridiculous, the gambling promotion that's going on.
Right.
And it's decadent and degrading, you know, it's degrading to people.
Okay. So the point is that we have to come to a point where we start applying discipline, but we can't get there until we can actually have honest conversations, not emotional conversations, not, you know, scientific baked data like climate change, those types of things, where we know they cook the books. But I believe, because the framers, they took, you know, the documents, the history that they read, and they realized, you know, the downfall of every society was because of the lack of morality. And so they kind of taught themselves, you know, to create a moral discipline in their society. Now, they actually had rules that I think are worthy of revisiting. Now, the states would require to basically not become theocratic, but they would require, you know, an encouragement of morality of some kind. In other words, they'd have to disband the education system. Government should not be in any compassion services. Let the churches and communities do that. But, we have to start putting things into the right hands of people, because you know, there's a lot of evil people that, you know, hey, it's okay if you engage in, you know, addictive behavior. That's what kids get out of school. Doesn't matter if it's drugs, sex, rock and roll. It doesn't matter. Whatever the addictive behavior is, go immerse yourself in it, because society's here to help you feel good. That's why we have welfare. That's why, you know, we allow people the freedom to destroy themselves. Now, they don't say those words to the kids, but what they do is they talk about how great it is to go and do these things, to feel good, and if it feels good, you know, do it type of thing. That's the mentality that they're getting in school, instead of good empirical data, disciplining, and so forth, to say, you know, the likelihood if you do these types of things, you know, this is what you'll be. Here are the statistics of what's going to happen to you as, you know, you continue to take drugs, as you continue to imbibe in alcohol or in gambling, pornography, all of these different, you know, addictive behaviors. They have the empirical data. Provide that empirical data to say, why would you want to end up like that? We'll be right back after this message.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
I really didn't mean to, you know, ponder so long on this, but, you know, they were at the point of, you know, this time, the 1770s. America was truly in its height, or, you know, it was up in that top area of its enlightenment. Because what they did and what they created literally laid the foundation for America to just move forward, where the people could become so complacent that regardless of the level of complacency, if you look at how complacent they were from the early 1800s, allowing the government to get away with these types of things with very little people standing up and saying, hey, you can't do that, and they get away with it anyway. If you look, I mean, look how long this republic and the laws and this nation has been able to sustain some similitude of liberty and freedom to this day without people really being, because we the people have stopped being active. The only time we really took a stand on anything was the abolition movement. And then the next stand was kind of on the prohibition movement, right, where the people kind of, you know, said, hey, we got to stop this. This is just wrong. It's destroying our families. We got to stop hard liquor. You know, it's the cause of, and it, America was going in the wrong direction at that point. But the Civil War, that was going in the right direction. So we can see kind of how we create, I'll just say, by using force, by using law, that doesn't do it. You can't create laws to discipline people. We have to instill the desire through the education system. But our education system has been antithetical to that. Our education system has been weaponizing our children to basically take the next step forward towards destroying ourselves. I mean, it's been very systematic. Talking about social engineering, our education system could be actually engineering us in the right direction as a society by disciplining. And you know, I'll say this. I remember when I had a job as a child working and earning money, there was nothing better than, you know, having the satisfaction of getting paid for my labor so I could go purchase something. And the freedom that I had, being able to buy something because it was my money and I got the, you know, the pants or whatever it was, the album that I wanted. Learning that basic fundamental of an honest wage for an honest day's work really hit home with me. Being able to, you know, go, I want to work. I want to go out there. I want to earn it so I can, you know, pay for myself. And, oh, you know, shoot, if I improve my capabilities, I can earn more. And that became, you know, a good thing in my life. Kids don't get that today. Kids put their hands out. Well, I need some money. You know, you want to do something, go, I need money. And, you know, anyway, I digress. But any other points you want to bring up on this? Because I think we can get there. But as we look at what they're talking about, what they're doing, you know, in some ways they had these disciplines. And they said, we're not going to do these things. We're, you know, because they weren't addicted to it at that point.
supposed, maybe some were, but the society wasn't that far along. Anyway,
I would think that they had way more, shall we say, austere upbringing and reality based, you know, principles, because they were hacking it out in, you know, we hadn't been there that long, and they had a whole different standard of living than we do today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I go out of my way to help people understand that in those days, infant mortality was so high. Talk about austere. I mean, you just had to have kids after kids after, because you didn't know if the last couple were going to live or not. They died at maybe age one or two. In Abigail and John Adams' letters back and forth, they talked about, you know, what not naming their children until age of two, because that was the time where a child could just die from whatever, because they didn't have, you know, the medical and research abilities to find out what these problems were. They didn't have those types of instruments. So that's one of the reasons why, one, they had big families, and with a big family, you could do a lot of things, you know, but with a family that got, you know, lost lots of children, it, you know, was a real hardship. But talk about austere. I mean, it was just a fact of life. Getting anywhere and, you know, the comforts of just being warm in the wintertime or being, you know, cool in the summertime. No AC, no HVAC systems. I mean, life was very austere. That is very true. And so it was definitely, you know, a quick consequence. You let that fire go out a little early, the cabin gets pretty cold. So you come up with whatever the processes are, and you kind of live by the process. You make the mistake of not following the process, then you pay the consequences. So, anywho, so it was very austere compared to today. The easier life gets for a person, the more they take it for granted. I mean, there's an old saying, you give a person a car and watch that person just destroy and ruin that car. Very few. I mean, the percentage is so low, I don't even know what it is, but I know it's so low because I've never seen anybody that's received a car that took care of it. Never. And I've seen all the time when people win the lottery how they become destitute, and their life is worse afterwards. Because everybody hates them. They didn't get enough from them. And because everybody's entitled to that money, and so forth and so on. So anyway, let's get back to the Articles of Association. But it's interesting how they're kind of working and, you know, as a society, they're speaking of what they're going to do. Okay, so Article 9.
Such as are vendors of goods or merchandise will not take advantage of the scarcity of goods that may be occasioned by this association, but will sell the same at the rates we have been respectively accustomed to do for 12 months last past. And if any vendor of goods or merchandise shall sell such goods on higher terms, or shall in any manner or by any device whatsoever violate or depart from this agreement, no person ought nor will any of us deal with any such person, or his or her factor or agent, at any time thereafter for any commodity whatever.
Okay, so what are they talking about there? Because this happens today where, you know, hey, it's the free market, right? You can get away with, you know, whatever price you want to do, right?
Right.
Okay, so did it seem like they were truly free market people by talking this way of saying, hey, you got to sell that thing for the same rate. Just because you can take advantage of people, we're not going to allow that.
Well, we deal with that down here in hurricane season.
Oh, absolutely. I know that. Absolutely.
Try to gouge you on, what do they call it?
Lumber? Lumber to put over your windows, your doors, to seal up your home? Oh, absolutely.
No, like for gasoline, because everybody's running generators and stuff.
Oh, sure.
They'll, like, raise the price twice to the market value because it's a crisis.
Yes.
And you don't have any choice but to buy it.
Water's the same way, going out and buying, you know, bottled water because there's only so much out there. Correct.
Yeah, so...
price gouging.
Yeah, it's just because the local availability is limited. And correct, price gouging. So one of the big things that always comes up is lumber, because there's definitely not enough lumber to go around, you know, to you take care of all the different households that want to buy that lumber. And so what do you do? Yeah, I mean, so you can create these types of laws, obviously. But here's the real problem, and I don't think anybody understands what dangers we are in right now with the consolidation of food. Because, you know, as mergers and acquisitions continue, and the grocery stores in your community go down, they're closing here, closing there. Well, when that happens, that means that because every grocery store is a repository of so much food. And even though you don't go to all of them, that what that does is it means that there's so – let's look at the produce in pounds, tons. Let's just say with 10 grocery stores, you have 10 tons of produce. Every grocery store has a ton. So you take three grocery stores out by mergers and acquisitions where they're no longer competing in a community because they've joined. Okay, so now you have seven. So you now have 7 tons of produce to serve the community, and nobody's claiming or crying because there's not enough for your daily consumption, because the way of the distribution, you know, the chains, the distribution chains that they use, it's almost on a daily, you know, JOT, just-in-time type of inventories and transits and inventory management. So they're very quick at getting the product to the store. But in all of a sudden, when there's some disaster where the chains of distribution have been shut down and you can't get anything, you've reduced your ability to survive as a community by allowing these mergers and acquisitions. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, nobody's looking over their shoulder going, hey, you know, this is a good, but the people are, these stores are making more and more money off of the fact that they are able to, you know, have less competition and their prices are going up. Interesting, isn't it? So the fact of the matter is as we kind of look at, you know, our, you know, this whole pricing, this whole community thing, when the big box stores came in and destroyed the local, I'll just say these local, you know, hardware stores, you know, ma and pa stores, because nobody wanted to look at the insurance, or I should say maintaining local sourcing, local labor, you know, that type of thing, we've decimated our communities big time by allowing these global corporations to come in. The states have failed to really protect us. It's one thing to say, you know, we have to have, you know, appropriate, you know, commodities of whatever it is, whether it be gas, food, what have you. But when we have plenty, and then all of a sudden they want to downsize, there's just barely enough to get by. And so these are realities that we actually have to look at, because we're going to be dealing with this. And if I this is one of the reasons I tell people, and I've told people, you know, go get yourself silver years ago, but before the digital currency started, get yourself silver. Right now, shoot, it's like $70 an ounce. And I tell people, go buy food. Oh, by the way, it's Honeyville, folks. If you go to Honeyville, you need to buy, and you're in an area that you're just paying outrageous prices for rice or what have you, go look at Honeyville. It's a flat shipping rate of $9. You can bring 2 tons to your house for $9. So it may cost you some money, but that's at least getting that food at a much better price. And this is food, you know, that would probably last you for a while. But anyway, I mean, people go and pay money. Look at what you pay from the Patriot, you know, places that are selling you survival food and so forth. I mean, you're paying an arm and a leg just for a few meals. When going out and buying these staples would probably be far better for you as far as making your money last. and being able to at least put some sustenance in you for a much longer time for the same amount of money. Anyway, I digress again. All right, so let's unless you've got something else you want to add.
No, sir.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get into this next article. 10, I believe.
Number 9, right?
Is it 9? Okay.
No, 10.
It is 10, okay.
In case any merchant, trader, or other person shall import any goods or merchandise after the first day of December and before the first day of February next, the same ought forthwith at the election of the owner to be either reshipped or delivered up to the committee of the country or town wherein they shall be imported to be stored at the risk of the importer until the non-importation agreement shall cease or be sold under the direction of the committee aforesaid. And in the last mentioned case, the owner or owners of such goods. Hold on just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Until the non-importation agreement shall cease or be sold under the direction of the committee aforesaid. And in the last mentioned case, the owner or owners of such goods shall be reimbursed out of the sales the first cost and charges, the profit, if any, to be applied towards relieving and employing such poor inhabitants of the town of Boston as are immediate sufferers by the Boston Port Bill, and a particular account of all goods so returned, stored, or sold to be inserted in the public papers. And if any goods or merchandises shall be imported after the said first day of February, the same ought forthwith to be sent back again without breaking any of the packages thereof.
Okay. All right. So, in other words, they're literally locking down every type of avenue possible in Britain making any advantages financially. They're shutting down as much as they possibly can the tight pipeline of flow of money out of these colonies to Britain. Because remember, the reason they're doing all of this is because they've got debt. Okay? So, Article 11 is a little bit interesting because now we kind of highlight this, but it all kind of speaks to, you know, the overall cause. Go ahead.
That a committee be chosen in every county, city, and town by those who are qualified to vote for representatives in the legislature, whose business it shall be attentively to observe the conduct of all persons touching this association. And when it shall be made to appear to the satisfaction of a majority of any such committee that any person within the limits of their appointment has violated this association, that such majority do forthwith cause the truth of the case to be published in the Gazette, to the end that all such foes to the rights of British America may be publicly known and universally contemned as the enemies of American liberty, and thenceforth we respectively will break off all dealings with him or her.
Okay, so there you go. So what they ended up doing was the areas within the states. Remember, they were talking about provincial governments in the Tory Acts. So whatever areas within the states that didn't create these provincial governments, they wanted to make sure that they saturated the countryside with people that were going to create these committees, councils, conventions, and or assemblies, right? The whatever these names were, for the cause of liberty. In other words, at a basic level, almost every state had some fundamental committees and assemblies, committees, and so forth. And that's how they created these committees of correspondence at the state level to form Continental Congress. That's basically how it formed, but they wanted to make sure that they brought everybody in. Here's the interesting thing. By doing this, they actually increased the saturation or the awareness of everybody, what was happening and what they were doing. People weren't just able to tune into the news, as I have said. So the only way they could actually find out was to actually create this type of mechanism, this type of local provincial representative government, so that they could hear and provide feedback, you know, two-way communications and so forth. So go ahead now in the 12th here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, just remarking on what you were talking about. It's a way for people to be informed about what was going on and the need to work together.
Right.
You know, in ways that they would feel and understand in their day-to-day lives.
Right. There you go. And what it does is it helps, it gives them buy-in. By having them do this, then they, you know, unwittingly get drawn into the involvement and get them involved. Okay, so now they reference the committees of correspondence. Go ahead.
That the committee of correspondence in the respective colonies do frequently inspect the entries of their custom houses and inform each other from time to time of the true state thereof and of every other material circumstance that may occur relative to this association.
Okay. All right, now the 13th article.
That all manufacturers of this country be sold at reasonable prices so that no undue advantage be taken of a future scarcity of goods.
Okay, so, you know, one of the things, because back in those days, they didn't really haul tomatoes from Virginia up to Massachusetts. There were certain things that were local only, and you could only buy them local, and you could only buy them during the season. They were available, and so very austere. If you didn't can, if you didn't dry, if you didn't do something to preserve food for the wintertime, you were going to starve. Or you better have a lot of grain alcohol just to get you through the winter, as we talked about before. But, okay, so the point here is that they were talking about these goods, furnishings or commodities that were transportable, tobacco, tea, those types of things that, you know, was, and even fish, meats, cured fish, and so forth. Okay, so let's read the final and 14th clause.
And we do further agree and resolve that we will have no trade, commerce, dealings, or intercourse whatsoever with any colony or province in North America which shall not accede to or which shall hereafter violate this association, but will hold them as unworthy of the rights of free men and as inimical to the liberties of their country. And we do solemnly bind ourselves and our constituents under the ties aforesaid to adhere to this association until such parts of the several acts of Parliament passed since the close of the last war as impose or continue duties on teas, on tea, wine, molasses, syrups, panelaise, coffee, sugar, pimento, indigo, foreign paper, glass, and painters' colors imported into America, and extend the powers of the Admiralty Courts beyond their ancient limits, deprive the American subject of trial by jury, authorize the judge's certificate to indemnify the prosecutor from damages that he might otherwise be liable to from a trial by his peers, require obsessive security from a claimant of ships or goods seized before he shall be allowed to defend his property, are repealed. And until that part of the Act of the 12G3, Chapter 24, entitled An Act for the Better Securing His Majesty's Dockyards, Magazines, Ships, Ammunition, and Stores, by which any person charged with committing any of the offenses therein described in America may be tried in any shire or county within the realm, is repealed, and until the four acts pass the last session of Parliament, viz. That for stopping the port and blocking up the harbor of Boston, that for altering the charter and government in Massachusetts Bay, and that which is entitled An Act for the Better Administration of Justice, and that for extending the limits of Quebec and Company are repealed, and we recommend it to the provincial conventions and to the committees in respective colonies to establish such farther regulations as they may think proper for carrying into execution this association.
Okay.
The foregoing association, yep, being determined upon by the Congress, was ordered to be subscribed by the several members thereof, and thereupon we have hereunto set our respective names accordingly.
All right, and this was done on the 20th of 1774, October 20th. And so you can kind of look at at the names here, and I highlight names that became very active in the cause. I mean, obviously John Jay. There's others that, I mean, I just didn't. But those who were, you know, very active, you know, like these are the who's who, Rutledge. I mean, both Rutledges. You go through this list and go, wow, you know, those names are all over the place within the many of these founding documents. Livingston of New York, he was at the Constitutional Convention. John Jay, he was, you know, the Supreme Court Justice. So as you go through these names, you go, oh, wow, okay, that's quite a company of men. Now, I noticed that they didn't have John Hancock. They had John Adams and Samuel Adams. I think John Hancock showed up a little later because I know he was the president a few times of the Continental Congress. But anyway, anything else to kind of add to this? Because the next document we're going to dive into is basically very similar. It almost states the same thing, but this is more of a direct petition to King George in demanding their rights as Englishmen and that they're going to do these things until there is this, either stop the taxation or give us representation type of thing. So anyway, anything else you want to add? We got about a minute and a half.
Where was Thomas Jefferson in this?
So Thomas Jefferson didn't show up until a little bit later. Because, as you notice, Washington was there, Edmund Pendleton and Benjamin Harris. I mean, those names were, and Richard Henry Lee. As a matter of fact, I think Jefferson was related to the Lees. But he didn't show up until 1775.
In Madison?
Madison did not participate. He was too young. He was a few years young. And same thing with Monroe. Monroe didn't get there. But when the war started, Monroe was a young man in the war. Hamilton was a young man in the war. Madison was unable to fight in war. He was too small and too weak, because of his health conditions. And for a man that was, had such health condition problems, he lived a full life. He didn't even imagine he would live a full life. He thought, Lord, just let me live long enough that I might be able to contribute some way. That was his common prayer, because when he would travel, and he had such a hard time traveling because of the bilge, this debilitating digestive problem, disease that he had. And so, there are times it's very discomforting, very painful, and, he would just be in prayer, Lord, just please bless me that I can, contribute. he was always being humbled. And I guess that's something that really helps people, keep in their respective lanes, so that they don't wander outside their lanes. But anyhow.
Sounds kind of like the Apostle Paul.
Yeah, you know what? You will probably find that there were even naysayers like Thomas. Anyway, with that, we will be back. And when we come back, we will have the first petition of Continental Congress to the king. In other words, they are actually showing us the customary and the most effective way of dealing with constitutional compliance, especially when the Constitution guarantees it. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.